On this episode of the Vincast, I chat with Marco Tinessa, the man behind Ognostro, amazing wines from the Taurasi region in Campania, Italy. Hello there, Vincasters, and welcome to another episode of the Vincast. My name is James Gersbrook, otherwise known as the Intrepid Wino. And let me start off by saying how lovely it is to be able to bring you more episodes of the podcast. It has obviously been a long time coming. The reality is that the current COVID-19 situation has meant that it's a little bit, you know, I've got a bit more time on my hands to be able to record, edit, and upload new episodes. It's a bit of a juggling act, considering that my wife and I had our second child about 6 weeks ago. And so, you know, it's about sort of making sure that there's time and it's quiet enough to be able to both record the interview and also this, you know, top and tail part of the episode. But it's also, you know, kind of freed things up. Obviously, most people are going to be at home and they're available via Zoom, whether they are here in Australia or overseas. So it has opened up opportunities for me, and I'm really excited to be having, you know, more guests coming on. Who knows, maybe I'll be able to have a new episode every week moving forward, at least for the time being. But I really appreciate everyone tuning in and listening, letting me know that they are listening. You know, if you do listen via the podcasts app or iTunes or any other number of different, you know, Google Podcasts or Spotify, there are different ways of listening to the podcast. But if you have the opportunity to leave a rating and a review, it really does help me out a lot. Of course, I'd love for more people to be able to find out about the podcast. There's, you know, over 150 episodes of the show available. You know, I sometimes get asked, oh, why don't you have this person on the podcast? And chances are I might have had them on, you know, maybe about 5 years ago. You know, a lot has changed since then, but you still get the opportunity to listen to their story and, you know, a bit of information about their background. So please let someone know about the podcast. Now's a great time to be listening to it, of course. But like I say, I really do appreciate people listening, and hopefully bring some new guests and some bigger and bigger things very soon. But for this episode, a long time overdue, I was able to chat with Marco Tinessa, who I was introduced to by his importer here in Australia, Michael Zaccaria from Corvino. He was quite insistent that I interview Marco because he told me that he had a fascinating story, and he does. You know, it's really fantastic. I chatted with him from where he was, over in Campania in Italy, which of course has suffered some pretty devastating impacts from COVID-19. They have had significantly more cases and deaths than we have here in Australia. So we should consider ourselves lucky, because it could be so much worse. But anyway, it was great to chat with Marco, find out about his story. And as we were recording, I actually tasted one of his delicious wines. So I hope you enjoy the episode. Stick around to the end to find out how you can actually find out more about Marco, and also find out more about, get in touch with me. But until then, I'll see you on the other side. Marco, thank you very much for making some time and joining me all the way from Campania in Italy on the Vincast.
Thank you, James.
Finally, we've managed to get together to chat after a lot of insistence of your importer here in Australia, Michael from Corvino.
Well, Michael, it's very enthusiastic about wine in general.
Yes, so very passionate.
I'm glad he's also enthusiastic about my story and my wine.
Yeah, yeah. He just kept saying, "Oh, it's such an interesting story. It's such an interesting story. You really should get him on." So I'm really glad to be able to introduce you to the listeners in Australia. And you'll have to forgive me. I have not really done many podcasts in a long time. I've been too busy, you know, with work and my family and stuff like that. But now I have a little bit more time on my hands, so I'm glad to be able to revive my podcast and for you to be my proper first guest back in, I think, a year and a half.
Oh, wow.
I generally start every episode of my podcast by asking my guest if they can remember the first time they felt that wine was important, you know, the first interaction that had an impact that potentially led them on a path to being a wine lover and having a career in wine.
Oh, yes, I remember it perfectly. It was long time ago, 27 years ago. I was 18, visiting Tuscany and going out for dinner with friends. And I remember a friend of mine said, "Okay, let's go to this enoteca." You know, these sort of shops that sell wine and also serve some food.
Yes.
And I said, "Oh, no, let's go to a proper restaurant." And he said, "How come you love food so much and you are not into wine?" And I said, "Okay, let's give it a try." And he started ordering some proper wines. You know, you have to put in things in context. I was coming from this little village in the south of Italy, in the middle of nowhere, no wine shops, no good wine to drink, really. You go to Tuscany, to Florence, in a wonderful wine shop, and you start drinking Brunello, Chianti, Sauternes with a dessert. So I said, "Oh, wow, now I understand why people go crazy about wine. I want to know more." And since that moment, I started putting really attention on the wine I was ordering, drinking. I started visiting producers, and I realized wine was a new world I was super interested in.
But food was something that was important to you. Was this something, you know, it's not unusual in Italy for, you know, a lot of love, you know, in terms of the family. Food being very important. Is this more important, particularly in the south of Italy, do you think?
Of course. Food is part of our culture, and I was raised in Campania, which since Roman time, Romans used to call Campania Felix, happy Campania, because everything you would plant here will grow perfectly, because we have the mountains, we have the seaside, the soil is fantastic because we used to have a few volcanoes. We only have one active volcano now, Vesuvius, but we used to have many. So, and I grew up in a family with my father working in the food industry, and he was back at home at 2:30 p.m. and we had lunch at 2:30 while the school would finish at 1. So I remember myself cooking with my mom every day, having fun and knowing about ingredients. You know, I think food is really important, and I'm always really skeptical when I see winemakers or wine lovers that don't care about what they eat. I think that the equation just doesn't work. If you have a taste for wine, I think you are supposed to have a taste for food as well.
Well, I think it shows that those kinds of people are in fact very separated from what wine actually is. It is an agricultural product, so you must to some extent be a farmer at heart and want to grow something of the highest quality, and you should also have that philosophy for food, I think. And if you don't grow food yourself, then you should want to buy the best quality raw materials and want to cook, or you know, or to at least, you know, go to restaurants where they have a real care for sourcing the best ingredients and to present them in the best way possible.
Yes, I totally agree. I think that 90% plus of people just eat and drink without thinking too much about it. And then there is 9% who really cares. And someone might argue that then there is a 1% that it goes really mad about it. And I'm definitely in that 1%. And you can ask Michael when he was visiting me in Campania how much I was passionate about local broccoli, local vegetables, because of the land. And one of the main focus of winemaking, which is yield in the vineyard, we spend our life trying to figure out what's the perfect balance of the vineyard, the yield per hectare, per vine, and blah, blah, blah. I still have this memory in my mind that when I was a kid, my father would take some peaches off the tree arm. And I was wondering why. I asked that, why are you doing that? These are good peaches. And he replied, you will see the ones that are left will be so much better. So I still have this memory, and this tells you a lot about the culture of people here in agriculture. They really aim at getting the best quality and fruits and vegetable and with flavors as well. So I think most of my passion comes from growing in this environment.
I think that the as far as wine, that is, you know, more recently, like when I say recently, you know, of course, because Italy has an extremely long history of viticulture and winemaking, this kind of like the cooperative kind of concept in Italy, as many other countries in Europe, meant that most people who are growing grapes, you know, wanted to produce more quantity to get, you know, more money. They would say, oh, the more I grow, the more I can sell. There wasn't so much attention to quality and thinking, well, if I grow less and grow well, I can actually get a higher price for the grapes. But if you're in a cooperative, it's not really as important. So with so many more families in Italy who are, you know, saying, no, we want to make our own wine from our own vineyards, and we have this attention to detail to get the best quality because we know we can sell the wine for a much higher price and make more money. If you know, so that's something that I think, you know, is certainly been with food for a long, long time. You know, like the appellation system, you know, the DOC or DOP system in Italy, is something that is so important for quality, and regionality is so important as well. Which part of Campania did you grow up in?
I'm from the countryside, so I'm 1 hour drive from the seaside, and the landscape here is completely different because we have mountains. So we
Yes.
are in the south, we have the sun of the south, but we are on the mountains. And I really feel what you just said on yields and production systems, because the place where I come from is totally focused on quantities, especially my province, which is the smallest province in Campania, but still the production of wine is higher than the combined other four provinces of Campania. So this really, when I started traveling and seeing how the great wines were made, I really went mad. And I said, come on, we've been doing wines for millenniums because we have proof that here there were old wineries in at Roman times, and our mountains are mentioned in books by Roman storytellers. And
Yeah, like I
still,
think
we just produce.
Pliny the Younger talked about
Yes,
wines from here.
Ovidio, a lot of Romans. We have actually. We have some really funny story. Like, for example, on my mountains, in a Roman book, we find a grape varietal called Cabernica, which really reminds me the name of Cabernet. So it's really funny because, of course, we don't know the real story, but you can imagine that wine in France arrived through Italy, no? Because it was coming from Middle East. So we have such a long history, and still we are not known for great wine, but only for bulky wines. And this was this combined with the fashion of using the barrique in the late 90s, because everyone wanted to make wines in line with the Parker style and international style. So everyone here started making bulky wine, like always, but with a touch of barrique taste. And this was this is when I said, okay, enough is enough. I have to make a proper Aglianico in the old traditional style, but trying to focus on quality and with the right yields in the vineyards.
But if I can go back, when you were 18, were you in you're studying in university? Like when you first kind of found a more an interest for wine?
Yes, I left my little village in the south and I moved to Milan, which is the international city in Italy. And I studied business economics, and I got a degree, started working in the finance industry, traveling the world, making enough money to drink the good wines. Well, arguably 20 years ago, except with the exception of the great Bordeaux names, wine was really affordable. Even Burgundy actually was cheap compared to Bordeaux. So wine lovers...
But still very scarce.
Well, no, it was very...
Not like
easy.
Now, but still.
Yeah, because the production is extremely lower than Bordeaux, and the big names make a fraction of the bottlers that the big chateau make in Bordeaux. But it was very easy to find it because wine was not a cool subject. And so only wine lovers were really drinking Burgundy. Investors, big restaurants, they were only buying Bordeaux. It was a game for a few people to drink the big names. Now it's cool and everybody's after Burgundy, or now it's so funny that everyone is after, I don't know in Australia, but here in
the... Yeah, it's the same. I know what you're going to say. It's the commodifying of, you know, cult natural wine producers. It's so strange.
Yeah, but also some area like Jura, like
yes,
for example,
exactly.
Or Beaujolais. Yep. These were the area where
Etna, to some extent, it's happening a bit.
Yeah, Etna, but Etna, I can see, is still not expensive. I mean, at least in Italy, you can buy a bottle for 15 euros. And it's funny because 20 years ago, this area did not exist and it's now on the map, but there is a reason. I mean, this is an area where 20 years ago, there were farmers selling bulky wines. And then a lot of people arrived and invested real money, and people from other regions, big professionals, they made high quality wineries. And the area has been transformed from a low quality, big quantities area into high quality area. I mean, we might argue what's quality in wine, it's very difficult, but I can tell you that there are many, many professional wineries on the Etna. So in a way, I can see where this is coming from. What I really, I struggle to accept is that areas like Jura or like Beaujolais, now if people just struggle to buy bottles because they are rare. People go crazy when something is rare. Let's assume we make this podcast and then, a major magazine in the US make a big article on a Gnostro and it becomes rare. People will start paying hundreds of dollars to get the same bottle that was available for, $20, $30 the month before. This drives me crazy. While if you love wine,
you studied and you worked in finance, you understand the concept of supply and demand. You know,
yes, completely.
Demand increases, you know, whether artificially or not. You know, the suggestion is that the price increases as well. People are willing to pay more because it is rare or it is finite, and there is a very big demand for something. You know, and that's kind of where it's I struggle because, you know, because I don't like to think of wine as a commodity. It is, you know, it is a product of the earth to some extent. It is an agricultural product. It's not, you know, we're not as humans, we don't contribute a lot to it. Nature, you know, and thousands of years of accumulated understanding about agriculture and winemaking, fermentation, has led us to this point. We can't claim that we are doing something very unique with wine, and yet there is this idea of wine as a commodity, and that increases the price. That kind of is, for me, it's divorced from what wine is, you know, and that's where I'm less interested in those kinds of wines. Yeah, Bordeaux for the longest time is something that I wasn't interested in, because the reality of what it actually takes to make a bottle of Bordeaux is a long way from what a bottle of Bordeaux would sell for.
Yeah, I'm totally with you, and that's why that was my point. We should stop following those fashions. I mean, Barolo, for example, in Italy is a great, great appellation. I love that. But there are many names that I was buying in the 90s and I'm not buying now because of this fashion, because even in the finance industry, stock markets works, they follow fashions, no? Growth stock, value stocks, blah, blah, blah. And the magic about wine is that you can find, you can always, if you travel, if you are eager to discover, you can always find a very good producer that makes an amazing wine, and which is also a good value for money. Maybe because he just bought that company, maybe because the father was making the wine in a different way, and now the son is taking over and following a different procedure at the cellar.
Maybe so, because the family were part of a cooperative previously, and then they decided to make a wine ourselves and our own way.
Or maybe because Yes. Or maybe because the father was older and was trying to please Antonio Galloni in the state, and so was making an ordinary wine just meant for the international market. And I don't know, there are hundreds of potential reasons. But my point is, if you are really into wine, which is what you said, an agricultural product, you should not follow those crazy fashion. Okay, I think it's fine to spend a few hundreds for a great bottle every now and then, because you have to have a big culture and to be able, it's wonderful to be able to put wine in context and know the story about wine, the evolution of winemaking. This is absolutely amazing. But in the end, what is wine? Wine is a joy, is a product that should give you an emotion, no? Small or big, an emotion is like going to a nice restaurant. You want to have fun with your friends. We should go back to this very basic but very important concept. In fact, the logo of my company is a man that hands over the bottle to another man. Because the statement is that the wine is a product made by men for men. So this is a very, very important concept that nowadays, I mean, it should be obvious, but nowadays I see many importers, distributors struggling to get the latest producer of Burgundy or Champagne, while there are so many interesting area. And the wonderful thing of nowadays of technology, of internet, I am a small producer in the middle of nowhere in Campania, having a recording a podcast with a journalist, or let's say journalist.
Sure.
Even if you are not officially, I don't know, are you officially a journalist or?
No. I mean, I was writing my own blog whilst I was traveling. Like I traveled across Europe, and I was just writing about the regions and the wineries that I was visiting. And whilst I was traveling, that's where I thought I would like to start a podcast in Australia, just to talk to people from different parts of the wine industry and find out their story, their journey, their background. That's all.
So yeah, this is wonderful, because I'm a small producer in the middle of nowhere in south of Italy. You are not a professional journalist, but still we do this mainly because of passions. So we have an audience that just thinks and behaves like us. And this is a great opportunity. And there are many wine lovers like me that nowadays have the chance to visit great producers, learn something, go back to their hometown and do something new. I mean, I didn't study enology, but I have visited the best producer in Europe, at least. And the knowledge I have today, it's terrific because of the visits and the trips I had. And today this is possible, and you can go back home and make something different, something nice.
But this is the difference.
It's a very interesting time.
This is the difference between someone, and forgive me, but someone who starts in the wine industry when they are young, whether they are working in viticulture and winemaking or as a sommelier, you know, there could potentially be this confusion between being a lover of wine and very passionate, but also it is a vocation. You know, for some people, maybe they have, you know, done something else for a period of time, but they had this love of wine, and that more if they thought about it, they wanted to follow a path in wine and do something themselves, but they're bringing a different perspective and they are doing it purely because they love it. If they can make enough money to support themselves or support their family and have the best life that they can, that's the only thing that matters. They don't want to be very, very wealthy, but you know, there are still plenty of people or companies who are really trying to make the most money they can, and that's not necessarily going to be doing it for the right reasons. And I think that certainly, it seems like that's the case with you, because you know, you did go, you know, you left your hometown and you went to study and you followed a career in finance, but you know, that's not necessarily something that you would want to kind of always be talking about. Like for me, I can't not talk about wine. I tend not to talk about it at home, because my wife is just sort of, just shut up. I don't want to hear about it. Yeah, it's enough. You make some wine, James. That's lovely. I'm happy to have a glass of wine, but just leave the talking about it to your work. But this is the thing. And this was certainly the case for me. You know, because you know, like everywhere else, Australia was in different levels of lockdown and isolation. And when I was able to start to go out a little bit and talk to people in the industry, I realized how much I missed talking about wine with people. Just nice conversation like we're having right now. But clearly, you know, as you kind of discovered wine, you know, you thought, oh, this, I'd like to be more involved. So you started to visit wine producers in Italy and then other parts of Europe. Anywhere else?
Yes. I go regularly to Burgundy and Rhone, because it's a 4.5 hours drive from Milano. And for 6-7 years, I went once a year in Germany to attend the Riesling auctions. I don't know that if you know that all the producers of Riesling in the Mosel Valley, in the Saar Valley, they put on auction every year their best parcels of wine. And there is a wonderful event going on in different days, in different villages, where you go, you taste the wine of the vintage, both the selection for the auction and the regular bottles for the market. And you taste and you bid for the wines that you like. So by traveling, I start feeling that I had something to say in the wine world. And then back at the time, 15, 20 years ago, really there was this dominant view on the wine industry that the wine was meant to be very concentrated, smooth, similar to Bordeaux. So the more I knew about wine, the more I realized that the path that all the local producers in my hometown were pursuing was something completely different from what we were coming from and from what I like. So I started my own venture. Initially with another guy, Frank Cornelissen on the Etna, which is one of the producers that has changed completely the landscape on the Etna, because he has been one of the first to introduce amphora winemaking without chemicals, all of these things that nowadays are so common, and we might call them natural wine making.
I prefer to use the word traditional.
Yeah, tradition. I always say artisanal, because it's a way of making wine where the man is more involved and is not just following a recipe, because this is what enologists normally do. They bring wine to a certain temperature, they add the yeast, and then they add the different yeast for different level of sugar, blah, blah, blah. While the winemaking I like is the one where the man is involved, tastes the wine, and just think about whether the wine should get some more air, should be racked, should be pumped over, these traditional things that we have always been making with wine. But basically, this is how it all started. I would take care of a vineyard in Campania, working on different pruning to find the perfect balance in terms of yield of the vineyard, because I really believe that this is the key point, not treating with chemical and finding the right balance. You have to imagine, I was thinking about this when you were talking about price in wines, the appellation of Tarasi allows you to produce 120 quintals per hectare. A quintal is 100 kilos. I don't know if you have these measures in Australia.
But no, basically, we say tons.
Yeah,
tons,
so
tons per hectare.
120 quintals will be 12 tons of wine per hectare. I make 4, maximum 5, if the vintage is amazing. And then when you go at the winery, typically the yield wine, the ratio of wine to grapes can be around 75%. And I'm around 60, 65, because I press very gently the skins and blah, blah, blah. So, of course, it's a brave decision, because then you have to be able to convince the market through the quality of your product and through the explaining the products that the reason why you are asking a higher price is because there is a different work behind it. And this is just in the vineyard, but the same story is at the winery. You do everything manually, you can lose some product, you lose more product. So it's not easy to convince the market, but eventually I like to believe that if you make a good product, people that are really into wine, they'll figure it out. So I started with Frank because I was focused on the vineyard, and it was not economically viable to open my own winery. So we started with around 1,000 bottles, and then we moved to 2,000, 3,000. But when we got there, and the plan was to grow to 6, 7, 10, and then I would eventually open my own winery, suddenly Frank couldn't help me anymore because he had some trouble. He said that at the winery, I really never figured out what really happened, but it's okay because this was a very important time in my life where I was forced basically to take over the whole vinification process. And it happened in the best possible way. In Italy, we have a way of saying that says sometimes a door would close, but a gate will open. And this is what happened because I met just by coincidence, that's that night when Frank told me he couldn't help me anymore, with a Barolo producer. And this friend of mine saw me a bit depressed because I had I had to harvest the following week and still I didn't know where to go with my grapes. And the guy said to me, okay, what's the problem? Come to my cellar. I will give you a little space. You can use my equipment, but you take care of the whole vinification process. And this is really the best thing that could have happened because I was then forced to follow the whole process from the vineyard to the bottle. And guess what? I realized that was my mission. And this is when I decided to open my garage winery in Milano. In 2 years' time, I brought the production from 2,500 to 7,000 bottles. And this year, I made the final step. I quit my job as a broker. I moved back to my hometown. I'm opening my big winery, big compared to the Milan garage. Don't think that it's anything gigantic. But I'm opening my proper cellar. I've bought a new piece of land. I rented a new piece of land. And I'm aiming at 15,000-20,000 bottles, which is the level that I think makes a winery economically viable.
So when you were initially producing some wine, the grapes were going to Sicily? You're making them there?
Yes. I was harvesting. I was taking care of the vineyard in Campania, and after the harvest, I was driving this little truck all the way down to Sicily. But I mean, Sicily was just another place. It's only because I was a good friend with Cornelissen, and he was one of the very few to use clay amphora, fiberglass, and all these neutral recipient back at the time. You really have to put things in context at the time. Every Taurasi producer, everyone was using barrique. Well, say, I don't know all of them, but say 95%. And so I didn't know any winery in Milano. There was no winery in Milano where I was living. So I thought the obvious choice was to cooperate with Frank and exploring that path. Because again, 20 years ago, this artisanal kind of winemaking in Italy, in France, it started in the late 80s, probably. Imagine that Le Fleuve, Madame Le Fleuve, the lady of organic wine, moved their winery to fully organic, I think, in 93 only, even if she started with organic in the 80s. So imagine in the early 2000 in Italy, we were just a bunch of wine lovers and that really believed that was the right path to follow.
And when you were making the wine in Milano, like it was like at your house or it was like a warehouse, like what kind of setup was it? And the same thing, you were just driving the grapes up from from Taurasi to Milano.
Yes, except that it was a larger quantity of grapes, so I pay a professional transporter with a refrigerated truck. And instead of driving with a little truck with 100 cases, I would bring to Milan 600 cases or 500 cases between white and red. I rented a garage underneath a wonderful restaurant. I used to visit once a month this restaurant in the suburbs of Milano, which has a wonderful garden, and they do all these organic, that they sell and transform all these organic products from all over the places in Italy. And it was one of my favorite restaurants by far. This guy was buying my wine. And one day I asked him, what do you have in the basement? I mean, it must be a very huge space. And he said, oh, yes, it's as big as the restaurant, which is 300 something square meters. So I guess more than 1,000 square foot. It's a big restaurant. We went to the basement and he said, you see, I just pile up stuff and then every 3-4 years I go to the dump and I throw it away. And I said, okay, why don't you give me a little part of this basement, of this garage, so that I can make some wine? And he said, yes, why not? Looks like a lovely idea. And that's how it all started. I prepared the space. I asked for permission from the healthcare authority and blah, blah, blah. And for 2 years, I started making wine in this basement. And then I got involved so much and so well that I bought some extra land and I immediately felt I needed more space. So this is why I took the decision to make the final step, because with 7,000 bottles of production now, it's very hard to continue the work as a stockbroker and run a winery. And honestly, I really prefer being here closer to the vineyards and have more time and more focus on winemaking.
Yeah, of course. I mean, like you certainly seem like someone who has the most respect for, you know, the really hard work is actually spent in the vineyard and having a relationship with the soils and with the vines. And I'm sure it must have been very difficult for you being, you know, further away and not being able to be there, you know, almost every day. And I'm sure it must be very, you know, like so great for you. A wonderful feeling to actually be so close to where the grapes are being grown and to sort of have that close relationship with the land.
It's incredible. I feel like I've wasted a lot of time and I'm doing what I've always wanted to do. And when I was in Milano, it was really crazy. Imagine that, just to give you an example, the decision of when to harvest is taken just by tasting the grapes. So rather than taking a plane every 4 or 5 days, because from Milano to Naples to Campania, when you have to come quickly to the vineyard, either you take 5-hour trains or you take a 1-hour plane. So when there was something important to do in the vineyard, I would always fly or take the train to Campania. But when the harvest is approaching and I stop treating the vineyard, you know, I stop treating the vineyard in July, even if I harvest in November. Aglianico, it's a very late ripening grapes, so we go as far as early November. I stop treating in July, so it's just cleaning the rotten clusters in August, September, November, if there are any. So the decision to harvest, in order to avoid the plains, I had a friend going in the vineyard, picking a different grains or little part of cluster, putting them in a box and shipping over to Milan with the next day delivery. And so I could taste the cluster from different parts of the vineyard and taking the decision whether the grapes were ripe enough to be harvested. It's been crazy for 15 years. Crazy.
Yeah. I can imagine.
And imagine the decision to rack Sometimes Frank would tell me, Marco, I think the wine is very on the reductive notes now. We should do an extra ragging, for example. I would take a flight to Sicily to taste and take the decision with Frank. It's been very, very crazy. And the space, imagine in Milano, you're doing everything in 40 square meters, which is probably 120 square feet. And now I have almost 10 times that space. And it's funny because if you put the press in the cellar in Milano, you have to do to take the pump outside the cellar. So you need the longer hose to run the press and the pump at the same time. It's really crazy, really crazy. And now I feel like I can really work properly.
And so, look, you know, I'm not sure if Michael mentioned it to you, but I actually make some wine myself. And I, you know, it's a similar sort of thing with Frank where, you know, I'm basically leasing some space in a winery and I work very closely with someone who, you know, is advising me, someone who's with a lot more experience, but it's a similar sort of thing. At least until this year when I was actually able to be there, you know, every day I needed to during vintage. But in previous years, I'd rely on them to say, oh, look, you know, the ferment is getting a bit hot. You know, maybe you need to do some pumping over to regulate the temperature a bit. You know, oh, you know, the sulfur is a little bit low. Maybe like we need to sort of rack and look at adding a little bit of sulfur, that kind of thing. So, you know, that's something that I've really understood a lot more, is how much more you can learn, but also how much better the wines can be when you have that close personal relationship with the wines. And if you know, distance is one of the biggest challenges for producing quality wine, whether it's, you know, you're taking the grapes from somewhere, you know, and making them in a very different area, or whether you yourself can't get to the vineyard. When you can actually be there and you're not taking, you're not transporting the grapes or the wine very far, you know, the wine, you know, can be a lot better that way. And you understand them a lot more. So I can imagine it must be so freeing and, you know, you can find so many more efficiencies and better ways of working in your own space with more space to work in.
Yes, yes, and it makes your life easier because you can use equipment to move the bottles around. For example, we just had the bottling in Milano. The truck came with the bottling machine. I was pumping over the wine from the basement to the road level. And then since the path to go down in the basement is it's very steep, we couldn't put the bottles in the big steel cage where the bottles are supposed to be stored. So we had to bring manually the bottles in the basement and then put them in the steel cage to store them. It's been crazy. But the main point is what you just said, that you have this close relationship with the winemaking process. If you ask me what is the main point, the most important factor in winemaking, my answer is clearly devotion. I think it's difficult to find amazing wines. I mean, I'm really talking about emotional wines, because wine is really, in agriculture, it's really a product that requires an incredible amount of devotion, because it's like a chef cooking a recipe for 2-3 months. So you have to be there every single day and taste and run analysis or test or measure the level of sugar and blah, 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 to know if everything is going the right way. Every single day, maybe night and day during certain times. And so the level of attention and devotion that the wine requires is terrific. And so maybe it's not fair for me to say I'm doing higher quality wines because this might sound somewhat disrespectful of what of who was helping me before, but I can certainly say that wines nowadays are 100% reflection of my taste.
Because precisely, that's the thing. Like you, because I know it seems very cliche, but I make the comparison, and it's something that I can do now that I have two children of my own. But you know, making wine is like being a parent, and 75% of parenting is just showing up. It's just being there, because like a child, a wine is not the same every day. It's constantly changing. So being there every day or almost every day and seeing the changes gives you much more confidence and understanding about the wines and what you are doing and how you can impact without changing it necessarily. So you know, by
opening a vat and giving some more air, you can change the course of the wine.
And that's not this intervening, you know, like that. For me, that's the concept of low intervention. It's not doing nothing. It's just doing enough.
No, you do a lot
at the right time. Exactly.
I agree.
You know.
I'm totally with you. That's why I mean. I think nowadays it doesn't really make that much sense talking about low, high intervention, natural wine or whatsoever. We want good wine where the man is taking the leadership. I have this sentence from Leonardo da Vinci in my winery that says, nature is full of infinite reasons, no? You can come up with the endless possibility with starting from the same vineyard. Even a pizza man will tell you that if we start from the same dope, the pizza will be different because of the way you make the you run it and blah blah blah. So I think the man is very important. It's crucial in preserving the and being transparent to the wonderful grape that he brought at the cellar. But it's not just like children's. It's like even in love, in human relationship, if you really want to build something, you have to show that you are there. And I think the amount of devotion that the wine requires is exactly what makes this product magic. Mm. I mean, I'm here in Campania, and what I'm doing now, because I have more time on the ground, is I'm trying to analyze the different soils of the different part of my mountains. Because we don't have this Grand Cru or Premier Cru classification made by Cistercienses monks or whatever. So I'm trying to discover what's the best area to plant Aglianico, to plant Fiano, to plant local grape varietals. I'm selecting shoots from very old vines and bringing them to this guy who makes new vines that I will be planting next year. You know, we design the landscape. We select the best clones of vines. We decide how to plant them, the density per hectare, how to train them, cordon spurring, guyot, pergola. So actually, the man takes a lot of decision, and you end up seeing the results of this after 10, 15, 20 years, and more so as the vines get older. So you will see the results of what I'm doing today to select a new piece of land in 10, 15 years.
Yes.
This is amazing. Keeping that level of consistency and devotion for 10, 20 years, if you think about it, it's something rare, something magic.
Like that's kind of the thing, that one of the problems that I have with this concept of low intervention is that, you know, the reality is that the best quality wines are a process of knowing as much as possible so that you don't have to do very much. If you can, if it's about, it's about some preparation, it's about learning and studying and observing, listening to everything around you and asking questions, like talking with other people, because that will give you much better understanding to make the right decisions, to sort of be able to observe something and sort of say, yes, I'm confident. I know what I'm doing here. I know this is the right choice, because then you don't have to fix mistakes ultimately.
Exactly.
You know, and you don't need to be making wine or growing grapes by recipe, you know, because that is taking away, you know, the important job that nature does. You know, you have to allow nature to make a contribution as well. But
totally. I mean, and this is very true in the vineyard. I mean, if you plant the vineyard in the very right place, which is not so obvious today, because in the past, when you didn't have so much options to protect the grapes and to adjust the grapes and the wine at the winery, people really started with a basic question. Is this the right place to put the vineyard? Is this the right place to put olive trees and blah, blah, blah? Nowadays, man is putting vineyards everywhere because they know that with chemical, both at the vineyards and at the winery, they can get any product they like, ultimately. I've been traveling to Barolo and Lange for decades because I really love wines from this area. For me, it's very sad when you get there, and it's funny because it's UNESCO heritage, so wonderful, but I'm very sad because I only see vineyard. I don't see the woods that there used to be. I don't see all this biodiversity. It's just vineyards. Montalcino in the 60s was 60 hectares. 60. Today is 2,000 hectares. So when you're buying a Brunello di Montalcino today, chances that you're really buying an original Brunello from where it was meant to come from is 3%. And then out of that 3%, you have to find a very good winemaker that gives you an emotion because he's so good at being transparent and low intervention and blah, blah, blah. And I think this is the reason why ultimately all the wine lovers around the world are after the same bottle of wine. We actually, the price goes up because we are competing for the same bottles, because it's hard to find a good spot.
It's like music, you know, very rare pressings of a vinyl record. You know, the people who are really, really into, you know, music find these rare kind of records in record shops, whereas, you know, the majority of people are getting these big mass-produced pop music that you can get anywhere, but they don't really appreciate the good stuff.
When you go to Japan and you buy these
wonderful
vinyl, because they have a sense of what is quality and...
because the Japanese, for me...
I understand.
You know, it's different. I do make comparisons with Italy, but in a different way. But the Japanese are still, like, they're true artisans in a lot of ways, even though they're, you know, it's very modern and they have worked out ways for manufacturing. But they still... In a basic level, the Japanese appreciate artisanal products.
They are wonderful. I mean, if you are very good at making something, you become part of national heritage. And I think if you think about low intervention, this is very much in line with their philosophy, with their culture. No, in the end, that their philosophy, the Oriental philosophy, is to take out from life unnecessary things. No?
That's efficiency for them.
Sorry?
This is the concept of efficiency to them. It's not to make things easier to produce, but to take out the unnecessary things to make things simple and pure.
It's wonderful. And to be honest with you, I mean, my main focus here is not just buy land to plant the vineyard, but it's to buy land around me to protect and preserve the wonderful biodiversity and environment we had. When Michael was here, he was taking picture of a cobweb in my vineyard. And I said, why are you doing that? And he said, because cobweb will never be in a vineyard that is chemically treated. But for us, it's obvious. And I have friends that are Barolo and Barbaresco producers. And when spring comes in April, May, they have to go out every single night to take these worms that would eat the vines. And we don't have that, because we are surrounded by the woods, we have birds, and we have all of these natural predators of parasites. So one of the advantage of being in an area that is unexploited is that the price of the land is cheap, and you can take care of the surrounding and the biodiversity and blah, blah, blah. And honestly, this together with barn selection, with restoring the very old clones of Aglianico, is my main focus now when I'm in the vineyards and in the countryside. And of course, at the winery is to be there for 3 months. I don't have a social life almost. I stay at the cellar, and I can't wait to see the products on the market made at the Milan winery, because this will finally be 100% reflection of my style, of my taste. So stay on the lookout that the first white and the 2017 red are the one made at the Milan winery, and you will see 100% of my philosophy there. And stay on the lookout for the next few years, because you will see how being closer to the vineyards gives you, I think, a better product. But the market and the clients and the people around the world will tell.
Well, in advance of our meeting, Michael very generously gave me a bottle of the 2015 Ognostro, which I have opened and I have been sipping whilst we've been talking, and it's wonderful. You know, there is a perception for Aglianico in generally, but also in Australia, that, you know, it's very, very heavy, it's very tannic. And I think, you know, this is potentially why in the past barrique was used so much, was to kind of soften these tannins. But yes, you know, like although there is, it's very expressive wine, I like that it's still very fresh, there's still a lot of energy and life. You know, the fruits are not super dark, there is some lovely red fruits here. And so, you know, this is from the 2015 vintage. I'm very excited, you know, to hopefully see some of the wines that you made in your garage winery at some point. And it sounds really, really exciting what you're going to be doing now, based in and around Taurasi. You know, because my mother, in fact, lived in Caserta when she was in her 20s for about four or 5 years. I had my first birthday there when I was a baby, she took me. So I have not by birth, but some, you know, family by marriage who originate from Campania. I still have a very close relationship, and it's exciting to see this kind of wine from Campania, from Taurasi, because I think I recently became more interested in the particularly Aglianico from Basilicata, from Vulture, because it felt a little bit more smooth, real, elegant, and rustic, and as you say, but also elegant, whereas the Aglianico from Campania and Taurasi became so big, you know, like tried to chase this international style. So now I think it's a great time, because we're starting to see more authentic, more traditional expressions of particularly Aglianico from Taurasi.
Yeah, James, thank you. I really appreciate what you said. And if you think about it, you now know why. I mean, since we are focused on quantities, and Aglianico, it's late ripening varietals. Imagine that you are in October and you have 12 tons of aglianico per hectare, and the weather is not nice, and the plant has to feed, every single vine has to feed 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 kilos, because we have this big pergola. Pergola can give you 20 kilo per single vine, and the weather is not nice. How can you possibly get bring this all of this grape to ripeness when you start to have rain? Like 18, the vintage that I'm going to release, I'm very proud of this vintage because it was very rainy. In October, we had something around 22 days of rain. 22, man. And still, I managed to get a very ripe fruit. How you get that? With low yields. As simple as that. You don't have to go too far, because otherwise you will have a very dark fruit and you will lose freshness. And you will be making jam and not wine. But working on the proper yield allows you to get a ripe fruit no matter the weather condition. Then, of course, if it's rainy, you will have a fresh and lighter vintage. If it's sunny, like 17, which I understand is the vintage currently on the Australian market, because it's the last vintage I put on the market. 18 is not out yet. It was very warm. We had no rain for 3 months, so very high in alcohol, but still working with a proper yield allows you to find that perfect balance that we all love between acidity, freshness, and ripeness of the fruit. And I'm totally with you when you say that the reason why probably Aglianico is not famous in the world is because it's difficult to find consistency. Some years they are okay, good, and some years they are just too tannic, because that year the climate didn't allow the grapes to reach perfect ripeness. And but I think this will change going forward. I have great hopes that the Aglianico will become more and more popular, because the quality will go up.
No, like the good news is that there are importers and wine writers and wine lovers in general who certainly can understand and appreciate that the Aglianico is something that is very, it is a variety that is very fantastic and so dependent on being in the right place, and why Paurazi is so great for Aglianico. Unfortunately, my now former employer, he is a lover of Aglianico, but says, really, the Aglianico needs time. The vines need to age. Yes. It's not until they get to a certain maturity where they have much more equilibrium and harmony, and they are finding the right yield levels to provide, concentration, but not to be too heavy and to have that balance in them. So, we now have planted quite a bit of Aglianico, but for me, it's still very, very early. And I think it will take time in Australia for us to find the right places for Aglianico. But we'll never make anything as good as what you find, on the slopes of the volcanoes in Italy. That's the reality.
Well, never say never. I like to believe that if you are sensible enough and you have a reason why you planted Aglianico in that place, you might succeed. Personally, I think that Aglianico needs the mountains and needs big temperature swings. And as you said, needs time. It's very complicated, because ripeness, getting a properly ripe fruit, is really an issue with Aglianico. Even inside the same cluster, James. And that's why, for example, the new vineyards I'm planting at Guyot train on one side only, because the cluster closer to the roots will give you certain notes, and farther one will give you different. I mean, it's a very, very complex grape varietal. But I like to think that if you are really focused on the grapes, on the pruning, you can get to a good result almost everywhere, provided you planted in the right place. But this applies to almost every varietal. I mean, arguably, there are some grape varietals that grow well everywhere, but you will never get to an amazing...
But there are also grape varieties that are just better, to be honest. You know, like I have the utmost respect for Fiano. I think it is just one of the best varieties in Italy
or
anywhere. but again, it has to be in the right place. And yes, we're only just starting to see, you know, Fiano in some better places in Australia, I think.
I love Fiano, James. I think it's an amazing grape varietals, and we
good
are
Fiano,
just about...
Honestly, I would drink good Fiano over good Burgundy any day.
Yeah, I'm with you.
That's just my taste. I love
Fiano. If you ask me my favorite two whites, I would tell you Chardonnay from Burgundy and Fiano.
Yeah, Fiano, I agree.
A similar characteristic in the sense that it's not, it's a little bit less fat, but it's elegant, mm-hmm. dry, mm-hmm. mineral. It has a nice length. It's wonderful. I rented three different plots to explore different soils. I'm starting to have my own idea of where to plant Fiano. I bought a piece of land on a rocky mountain just to plant Fiano. So I have a lot of things to do here. I mean, I always say to my friend that I'm busy for the next 20 years, because by the time you have an idea, you select the clones and you plant them and you make the wine and you see the vines aging and the wine aging.
Yeah.
It's so fascinating.
I agree. Like, you know, you can have a great idea, but that doesn't necessarily mean you know exactly what you're going to do. You need to think a little bit. You need to, like I said before, you need to study, you need to listen, you need to ask questions, and eventually you will find, you know, exactly what you want to do, and you will say, yes, the time I have spent, you know, thinking and preparing and understanding better has now resulted in what I think, you know, is a great product. So
but this is a job that takes generations,
yeah,
because
course,
I know that I'm doing this for my children or for whoever comes next. In fact, I'm working with the Ministry of Agriculture here to classify all the old vines that I'm taking the shoots from to make the new vines. And it's a work that takes... involves an entire life, and maybe
it never ends. It never
yeah,
ends.
And this is wonderful, because you are passing. You know, I really feel you are living an heritage to your community, to the place where you live. If you put life in perspective, this is really a wonderful job.
Yes, I agree.
I struggle to call it job, but...
No, I know. It's just life.
It is a job for me.
Yeah, of course. You know, now more than ever, it's difficult, you know, to actually be able to make a living from things. I can imagine how difficult it must be for everyone in Italy, you know, all the wonderful wine producers and families there in this struggle, because of course it's not just affecting our own country, it's affecting everyone, it's affecting the whole planet. But you know, if we're doing something that we are passionate about, and if we think, you know, we're making a positive contribution and providing something to pass on, then
yes,
you know, that's the most
wonderful.
Important thing.
Wonderful.
Marco, I really feel like I could just talk with you for hours, but unfortunately I do have to wrap things up, but I do want to say thank you so much. I really do appreciate your time. I'm sorry that it's taken me so long to organize this, but I really have enjoyed talking to you about your background. Is there
Do you have a website that you would like to let people know about? Of course, you know, people can find out more about your wines from Michael at Quelvino, but otherwise on social media.
Yes, I'm on Instagram, Facebook. You can drop me a line whenever you like on through every social media. I do have a website. It's very basic. I just give the concept behind the wine, and I like to give a hint on different vintages of my Ognostro. Honestly, I haven't been updating the website since I opened my own winery in Milano, because that took me a terrific amount of time. But now that I move into Campania and I quit my job as a banker, I will have more time. So I will certainly do some more. See, it's really wonderful for me, because I'm doing this out of passion, to get in touch with people around the world that I appreciate my job. So whenever you want to talk, drop me a line. I will be super happy. And don't worry, James. I'm used to wait decades to see things happening. So having wait a few weeks or months, I don't know, to get this podcast, it was nothing. and again, it's really flattering for me to see people around the world interested in what I'm doing. It makes me really happy, and it gives me the energy to go ahead and continue with this dream of low intervention artisanal winemaking in an area where this is not a common concept. It really gives me the energy to go ahead, and so I want to thank all of you guys around the world.
No, thank you, and honestly, keep up the fantastic work, and very excited to see all the future developments.
Sure, let's keep in touch.
Okay, grazie, Michael.
Grazie, James. A presto, ciao.
And thank you, listeners, for joining us on this episode of the Vincast. I have been James Gasbrook, otherwise known as the Intrepid Wino, and also the winemaker behind Vino Intrepido Wines. As I touched upon in this episode, I have been making my own wines. The last couple of vintages I've made, a little bit more, and hopefully in 2021 I'll be able to increase my production even more. Find out more about those wines at vinointrepido.com. I really appreciate people checking that out and supporting, particularly in these difficult circumstances. If you'd like to find out more about the podcast, you can head to my website, intrepidwino.com. There's also lots of other content on there, blog posts, tasting videos, that kind of thing. Of course, I'd love for you to subscribe to the podcast on your listening app or platform of choice. That means you get the newest episode as soon as it becomes available. And like I said at the beginning, it's an opportunity to share a rating and review, which does help me get the podcast out to more people. You can follow me on social media on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. I'm at Intrepid Wino. You can follow the podcast on Twitter at The Vincast. You can follow my wine brand on Facebook and Instagram at Vino Intrepido. Like I said, looking forward to releasing some new episodes coming up, some awesome guests, and hopefully some more international guests as well. But until next time, bye.